Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, I talk swans with Dr. Richard Collins. Terry Flanagan investigates what those frisky pigeons are getting up to in our public parks. And we discover how plastic pollution is choking the River Nile.
The amount of fish has depleted completely. Far less. 100 times less than what I saw as a kid. This was an industry that kept these people going because children could go to school. You could see a lot of cattle in the villages because it was fish. From the money from the fish, you buy cattle or you have money to plow your farm. So there was food everywhere. People were healthier. Today, I don't see people as healthy as they were. And I attribute the scanty number or the less number of fish to pollution, overfishing, poor fishing methods. But I think the worst is the plastics.
You can email Mooney at rte.ie or text us now about anything at all to 51551. Yeah, very busy program ahead of us today, and we really do want to hear from you. That text number again is 51551 about anything at all. I'm alone again. I was alone last week. We are alive. Aidan Elana and Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Challenge outside on the grounds of RTE somewhere. Aidan, where exactly? You there?
Who do you think I am, Derek? I've heard say the studio is on my way in and I'm standing under the trees. There's a beech tree, there's a sycamore tree, there's a birch tree. Oh, there's Niall Hatch. Hello, Niall. How are you doing?
Hi, Aina. I'm very well. Good to see you. I'm on my way in now as well. Nice day, isn't it?
Lovely. It's lovely indeed. I'm out here to look at the grey, not the birds, even though you're with me. I'm out here to look at the grey squirrels. What's in the trees? This place is crawling with grey squirrels. Did you know that?
I've seen a fair few when I'm going in and out of here, and I like squirrels a lot, I have to say. I think of squirrels as being honorary birds because they like being up in the trees, they're out during the day, so bird watchers tend to see them with their binoculars. I grew up not too far from here, a few kilometres down the road, in Killiney, and it used to be there you would find red squirrels coming to the garden. This is many years ago now, but over time I've seen the greys coming in more and more, and you still find red squirrels on Killiney Hill, but outside of that you don't really get them much else in other parts of Dublin. And here on the RTE campus it's all greys, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's all greys indeed all over the city inside the M50 more or less, because they have taken over from the red. You know, the grey squirrels were introduced to Ireland as a wedding present, if you wouldn't be minding, way back in 1911. And they have spread, and they're really nasty creatures because they pushed out the greys. The greys pushed out the reds. And you said they're honorary birds. Look at that bird box there. Look, the one with the robin's half door on it. I bet you there's no robins in there, or if there were, the squirrels wouldn't let them last long. I mean, these are grey squirrels that eat nuts. They are not. They're grey squirrels and they eat birds' eggs as well, don't they, Niall?
That's absolutely right. So yeah, I think that any bird nesting in such an exposed nest box there with all of these squirrels around, it doesn't have much of a chance of survival. Same would be true actually if there were red squirrels here, because they would happily eat those birds' eggs as well. They are rodents after all, and rodents are in many cases very omnivorous. So although squirrels do like to eat nuts if they get them, full of energy, full of nutrition, they'll happily eat eggs, they'll happily eat nestlings as well. They'll eat anything they can find really.
Yeah, and they do harm to the trees too, because, okay, they eat the nuts in the autumn time, but what do they eat the rest of the year? Shinny and Hesht. And what they eat, in fact, are the buds of the trees, the barks of the trees. They have the Phoenix Park ruined, they have, because they're damaging the trees and the trees won't grow. So they're not a good thing, really. I mean, people think, oh, they're lovely, whisking up the trees and they're wildlife, but they're an invasive species and I don't like them, Derek.
Oh my God, is there nothing good to be said for the Mena?
Well, I can't think of anything good to say about them. Can you, Niall?
I have to admit, they are quite cute. I mean, they are adorable looking animals. I think the red squirrels, our native squirrel, are even cuter. One of the things that could be said for them as well is that it seems perhaps that the grey squirrel has been leading to a resurgence of the pine marten, a native predator, member of the weasel family. I think that's good news. That's an animal we want to see spreading more in Ireland. They would traditionally be the big enemy of the red squirrel, but the greys are easier for them to catch and spend more time on the ground. So actually, perhaps the grey squirrel is doing some good for the pine martens.
But we have no pine martens inside the M50, so I don't think they're doing much good around here. So I think we will drag ourselves away from the presence of the grey squirrels and come in to see you, Derek.
OK, Aina, thank you very much indeed. And Niall. And while Aina and Niall are making their way up the steps into the radio centre, through the big offices and then down the stairs, subterranean-like, into the studios below ground, I'll steal away a few moments to talk to Richard Collins. Richard, are you still enjoying lockdown in Malahide?
Yes, I am out here with the sea rolling in and that sort of thing. It's a lovely place to be. How lucky I am, Derek. Not in that claustrophobic place where you live, but anyway, better not go down that road.
Anyway, while Niall and Aina are making their way back into the studio, Richard, I thought I'd steal a couple of moments to talk to you about swans. We've been monitoring the swans in Blessington Basin in Dublin for the past few weeks. When I say monitoring, I mean I'm popping over every now and again and I'm having a look at them because they were brought to my attention by one of our listeners. And you will remember I told you that they had 6 baby swans. And that I was there for their first swim. At least it looked like their first swim. And we had a little bit of a discussion like that. But at any rate, I was over there the other day, Richard, and I noticed that there were only 4. And I thought, oh no, she's lost 2 of her babies. And she's quite aggressive, this particular mute swan. She swims at gulls and everything else that's on the water to clear a path for those little cygnets to go into. But at any rate, there were only 4, and I thought, oh, this is dreadful. What's happened? Maybe the gulls got them, maybe the heron. There's a resident heron there as well. And then she turned around, she was like a dreadnought in the water, and I could see at the side that there were 2 little babies up on her back.
Yes, well, now we were lucky to see that because you don't often see it, and not close up. I managed to photograph it a few times, yes. It's a very interesting behaviour. It's not just swans do this, but lots of things do it. But anyway, for the swans bit. Now, there are thought to be 2 possible reasons why they do this. One is defence. If there's a threat, she'll pull back the leg. It's like an aeroplane gangway. And the babies will run up the leg and get in under her wing. Now, I have seen up to 6 babies hidden under the wing, and you would not know they were there at all. Now she's got them on board. She doesn't have to be looking around for them when the danger comes. Meanwhile, her mate is probably fighting off the threat. It's an extraordinary thing. It's common to a lot of birds. For instance, the black swans do it. The black-necked swans of South America, but the whooper, our other visiting swan in the winter, they don't do it. It is a curious sort of thing. Other birds do it. The famous one, of course, is the woodcock. Woodcock are supposed to carry, this was a very controversial, the 18th century, an Italian ornithologist claimed that this happened. I remember in Gilbert White's book, he said he didn't know whether this could be true or not. But a woodcock picks up its young and flies with them. The swans only swim with them.
Ah, that's impossible, Richard. Come on, how could a bird fly and have a bird on its back at the same time unless it was strapped on?
Well, it's thought that they carry the babies between their thighs. Now, for this has been a controversial thing since the 18th century, but now I think woodcock experts agree that it does happen, that it is an actual reality that they do this. For instance, redshank have been seen doing this, but in the redshank's case, it's only a very short flight. They come across an obstacle. Remember, the babies can't fly. They can only swim. They need to feed. And the redshank wants to get it to the far side of a road or an obstacle of some kind. And there are records where the redshank is thought to put a baby between its legs, fly over the obstacle and put it down the far side. Common sandpipers are said to do this as well. But it's a strange thing. The grebes, of course, carry babies on their backs. So do divers. Coot do it as well. It is an endearing kind of thing to see, I must say.
It is, but you said it could be done for security. Okay, fair enough. But why did she only have 2 on her back? Remember, she has 6 babies.
Well, now, I must say, Blessington Street is an interesting place. Now, because, first of all, it's very secure. There's nothing going to threaten her babies there unless some youths come in and throw stones at them, as has happened in the past. But I don't think she is experiencing great danger to her young. So the other motive must be, surely, to take them out of this little basin, which hasn't got shallow, muddy places after all. Now, what would she be thinking? They don't think in our sense, but the possible idea in her head is to go out through the little gate at the back.
No, that didn't happen, Richard. No.
It didn't go that far.
No,
she thinking that?
She had them on her back, and she was swimming around with them.
Yes.
While the others were in the water, and then eventually they jumped off her back and into the water, and that was it. She wasn't going anywhere with them.
No.
They're only a couple of weeks old still.
Yes.
3 weeks this week.
Well, if they get much bigger, she won't be able to do it. So it's
yeah, but why only two of them? That was my question.
Well,
you said it could be for security, but that makes no sense to leave the other four in the water.
The whole thing makes no sense in investing in the Street Basin, because the only thing it could be on our mind is a kind of indecision. If she triggered the behaviour, which she may not have done, after all, if she triggered the behaviour, then she's toying with the idea that this place isn't good enough. I have to get to someplace better. And she might be sort of betwixt and between, Derek.
Or is she teaching them, because we spoke about imprinting and how those babies imprint very quickly on the adult, is she teaching them the tricks of being a mum? You know, that you can carry your young on your back. And instilling that idea in them very young, because as you said also a couple of weeks ago, as soon as they get their white feathers, the father's going to run them out of town.
That's true, he is indeed. And you could well be right there, because they are a bird that depends on education, and everything is educational for the babies. It could well be something like that, but it's not thought out. It's an automatic system.
Fantastic. Richard, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Derek.
We'll talk to you later on. You can text about anything at all to 51551.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
And we'll be talking to Alex Crawford of Sky News a little bit later on about that plastic pollution on the river in Iowa. That'll be Richard's big interview towards the end of the programme. You get in touch with us, 51551, or email mooney@rte.ie. Ain, have you ever heard about the woodcock carrying its young?
Well, the woodcock.
Between its thighs.
The woodcock used to be on the farthing. And, you know, when I was young, farthings were still around. You'd be glad to get a farthing. We were so poor. And you'd look at the farthing and you'd look at the woodcock. But I must say, I never observed any small lads in between their legs. So, Niall, is this a load of rubbish? Like the way the swallows were all meant to hibernate at the end of ponds. I mean, those 17th century naturalists, I mean, did they know anything at all?
I'll just start by saying the farthing was a little ahead of my time. But
I do
remember them being on the 50 pence piece, though. So that was the bird, people might remember there. But apparently it is true. Yes, woodcock do carry their chicks sometimes when they're very small, between their thighs to take them away from danger. This was something that has been rumoured even for centuries, but ornithologists didn't believe it. Because it seems very unlikely. Birds generally don't do that. But it turns out, yes, woodcock actually do.
I always thought birds had to watch their weight. No. But seriously, you mean you can't. A heavy bird can't fly if it takes on too much weight.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the reasons why they can't do it. And you would think that, like, the way that some mammals would carry their young by the scruff of the neck in their mouths, birds never do that. You'd think sometimes it would make sense for a bird to transport its chick if danger is threatening. But they don't. They don't carry them in their beaks. And very few birds do this. As Richard mentioned, sometimes redshank, which are a member of the wader family, just like the woodcock, they will do it as well. But woodcock are the ones that are famous for it.
But they take off at an explosive flight, yes, and go zigzag. I mean, with two babbies hanging out here, it's pretty hard to do that.
It is. And it's you know, one of the reasons it took so long to confirm this as a fact is that woodcock aren't easy to see. They're very cryptically plumaged, which means, you know, they camouflage. They blend into the leaf litter. And they're a bird that they often just shoot up from underfoot walking through. They flush very, very late. So it's very hard to get a good look at them. And to actually see a little baby being held underneath, it's almost impossible.
Has it ever been filmed?
I don't know about filmed. Certainly, I've seen photographs. So probably
you have. Okay, yes. I'd love to see it. Would you, Aina? Be very curious. And I heard
the
also that
never lies.
The woodcock used to fly to the moon and back.
Well, that is a myth that has been debunked. Yeah, it used to be believed that woodcock migrated to the moon, literally. I can confirm that does not happen. There have been no photographs of them on the moon. That's certainly.
Well, then, what bird makes the longest migration?
Do you know?
Woodcock do migrate, don't they?
They do. So we have a resident population of woodcock, but in the winter we get some that come in from actually around the Ural Mountains that migrate into Ireland. That's quite a long distance, but the longest
turn.
Distance
I bet
all,
it's a turn.
It is. It's the Arctic turn.
Because it's the fade of the dark.
Well, they experience less darkness, less nighttime than any other
creature
on the planet.
Anybody else, because they go over the other side for the summer.
They have
over
two
there.
Summers, yeah. And they go from the Arctic to the Antarctic. We have a breeding population of them here in Ireland. This is about as far south as they would breed. They head down to Antarctica, though, and then they return. And what happens is that they don't just, you know, don't just go straight from Europe down to the Antarctic and back. They tracked some in recent years from the Netherlands, and they found out they actually fly up, and some of them come through the Irish Sea, stop at Sandymount Strand of all places, then head down along the coast of Africa, down West Africa, and then instead of going straight to Antarctica, what they do is they hang, they turn east and they head into the Indian Ocean, and they end up going past the Seychelles until they get to New Zealand, and they stage there, and then they head down to Antarctica from there, and then come back. So it's a huge distance, and they live for about 20-25 years. So in their lifetime, they cover a much greater distance than from here to the moon and back.
Oh, I see. All right. Hi, Derek and Co. That would be you and Aina. Hi, Derek and Co. Are there less swallows around this year? Now, we had Eric Dempsey's fabulous documentary about the swallow on last Monday night.
So we're still waiting to find out. Because of the COVID-19 situation, we in Birdwatch Ireland haven't been able to do as many surveys as we normally would. So sort of playing catch up at the moment on that. Certainly anecdotally, we are hearing people saying that they're not seeing swallows back, you know, as they did. But the fact, of course, is that people are more likely to contact us to let us know of an absence rather than presence when it comes to a common bird. So that's only anecdotal. It's not scientific. What I can say is that over the course of the last 20 or 30 years, swallow numbers have been decreasing. It seems that climate change is having a big impact on them. And of course, they're birds that rely very much on flying insects. That's all they eat. And with hedgerows destruction and no intensification of agriculture
and insecticide use,
it does affect them here too. So,
but these swallows come from South Africa, so they actually have to fly over the Sahara to get here. And would there be much by way of insects above the Sahara, given the Sahara is getting wider and wider because of drought?
Literally none. So what happens is that the Sahara Desert is getting wider, as you said, by about a mile each year, and the birds just have to blast across it. There's nothing they can do. So there's nowhere to shelter. There's nowhere to escape bad weather because they could run into heavy winds. There, that happens. There's nowhere to find any water, and so they just have to go across it. And the wider it gets, the fewer of them survive each year. The vast majority of swallows don't survive their first migration. We have to bear that in mind. Life is tough.
Life is very tough. I mentioned Eric's documentary last Monday evening on RT Radio 1. And just to remind you that we are still here on Monday evenings at 10 p.m. and we're giving you for the summer months a second chance to hear some of the documentaries from the Mooney Goes Wild archive. Tomorrow night, Terry Flanagan looks into the private life of the blackbird. In this clip, you'll hear him speaking with Brian Burke from Birdwatch Ireland.
Blackbirds as well, they have quite a large eye compared to the size of their body compared to other birds. They're usually the first ones up in the morning, the first ones singing and the first one people hear before they go to work.
Are they very territorial? I ask that because I notice in my garden, I never ever see two males. I'll only ever see a male and a female.
The males are really, really aggressive. They'll really guard their territory, even in winter. You know, they'll really, really keep an eye on their patch. And it's actually their orange bill that triggers that aggression. So you'll notice that the females usually, sometimes it's a bit yellow in the bill, but usually it's kind of a dark, kind of brownish colour in the bill. So that doesn't trigger that aggressive response in the males. And even the young blackbirds will have a bill very similar to the female. So that is not orange. It doesn't trigger that response. But if a male blackbird sees another male blackbird with an orange bill, it'll use up all its energy chasing it out of its territory.
And you can hear that documentary about the blackbird right here on RT Radio 1 on Mooney Goes Wild Second Chance Documentaries tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Now, wildlife around the world has been reacting to decreases in human activity caused by coronavirus restrictions. For example, national parks in France are reporting an increase in bird hatching numbers. This report from TRT World.
I think that the great benefit of this period of confinement for the fauna is above all the tranquility and the absence of human disturbance, which can favour reproductive success.
While in Lebanon, farmers are identifying rare bird species they've never seen before.
I don't know why. Maybe they're not frightened because there's no hunting, no noise from people or cars, no flights.
And in the heart of a very different city, a kangaroo was caught bounding down a deserted street in southern Australia. While most people are stuck inside, at least some Aussies are jumping for joy.
And closer to home, Damien Hannigan, Public Relations Officer of the Irish Deer Commission, tells us that deer have three basic requirements: food, shelter, peace and quiet. That's probably four, is it?
Peace and quiet is all the one.
Human disturbance and unwarranted vilification have resulted in deer becoming predominantly a nocturnal species in the wild and forcing them into new areas. So how has reduced human activity here in Ireland in the last couple of months affected deer activity? Damien joins us now from the Cork studios. Damien, hello. Welcome to the programme. Tell us more about this.
Good evening, Derek. Thanks for having me on.
Very welcome.
I suppose deer, like as you just mentioned, many other wildlife species, species have taken advantage, I suppose, of the reduced human activity that we've seen in Ireland and around the world. And, you know, we've seen reports of deer in urban areas or locations that would not normally be seen. And I suppose this has a knock-on effect of that has been that and it kind of coincides with a seasonal change in terms of deer, that we tend to see young bucks and stags leave their territory and pushed out by larger stags, and they go in search of their own new territory and form bachelor groups with younger stags. So I suppose these two incidents, both of the reduced human activity from COVID-19 and the seasonal movement of deer, mean that deer cross modes, cross roads more often, and they've really lost that fear of crossing roads, because obviously we've lot less traffic on the roads, but unfortunately it just takes one vehicle and one deer to have an accident, and we have seen an increase in the number of road traffic accidents involving deer in a number of locations.
And these are happening during daylight hours, are they, Damien? Because I know certainly at night people do come across deer on the road when they're driving at night, but there's not so much driving at night now. So is this happening in broad daylight?
Yeah, and very much so. Deer are typically most active between the hours of sunset and sunrise. But because of the reduced human activity, more and more we're seeing deer in daylight hours. And I suppose people are living in communities that maybe where they are used to seeing deer at night are suddenly now meeting deer during daylight hours. Obviously, in recent weeks, traffic levels are starting to build on the roads again, and it will obviously revert back to that warning of being vigilant it's particularly in forestry and mountainous areas that deer are on the move and crossing roads. And we would give advice to motorists on the road when they're driving in these areas. If they do see deer, is first of all, is be prepared that they will likely see deer, so to reduce their speed. If they do see a deer on the road, not to swerve to avoid them, because that brings them into contact with other motorists. But also deer tend to move in numbers as well. So often one deer may have a number of other deer following behind. So it's just advice we would say to motorists on the road, just to help reduce road traffic accidents.
Yeah, if you see one deer hopping out and running across the road, I mean, there could be three more after it indeed, and they're the ones you might be hitting. But the other thing they're doing at this time of the year, they've given birth, the females have, and they leave their fawns in the long grass, don't they, and come back and suckle them just once or twice a day. And people sometimes find these little fawns and think they have been abandoned. Is there any advice about that, do you think, Damien?
Yes, as you mentioned, yeah, it is one of the highlights of the wildlife calendar in terms of deer when the next generation of newborn deer are born. And, the general public, meanwhile, they come across these abandoned fawns or calves, and they feel that they're maybe abandoned and they should attempt a rescue. But in reality, deer, typically for the first 2 weeks after birth, the common behaviour would be is the female will hide their young in vegetation and go away to feed, and then return a short time later to suckle their young. And unfortunately, we regularly see instances of where people will, move the deer or bring them home and bring them to a wildlife rescue, where in reality, if they had actually left the animal where it is, they would be doing it the biggest favour, because typically the mother will be standing nearby watching on and will return once that person has moved away. So something we'd very much ask people to be conscious of, and particularly the month of June is really the peak of when the majority of newborn deer are born.
So mind your own business, essentially.
Does that mean that if the deer are in the grass, that the newborn ones, does that mean that things like silage cutting can pose a problem for them?
Yes, it's a very it's a significant issue, but typically in the silage cutting season in areas, particularly alongside forests or mountainous areas, female deer will use silage fields to hide their young, as do other wildlife species other than deer. And sadly, what happens is the deer, a newborn deer by its nature, when it's threatened or it will freeze, it won't move or run away. And unfortunately, as silage fields fields are cut, you know, a significant number of fawns and calves are killed unintentionally. And I suppose in many countries in Europe, and you know, an encouragement that we would give to contractors and farmers here is to, you know, there's a number of approaches that they can take to reduce kind of this incident, is to, you know, to cut silage fields from the centre out, or to cut in sections on consecutive days. And this allows wildlife to escape. I know in a number of other European countries it's common practice in areas where deer frequent, that the fields are actually walked in advance, just to remove any wildlife from the fields.
Of course, the red deer is our native species, but it's not the most common one. Sure, it's not.
Yeah, I suppose in terms of three deer species, we have red deer, as you mentioned, and we have fallow and sika deer. In terms of the actual numbers, are the most common. You know, it's a conversation that we are, a question, I suppose, that we're asked on a regular basis is, have we too many deer, or how many deer do we have? And the fact of the matter is that we've never undertaken a census of deer in Ireland, and are obviously wild animals, and the habitat that they live in is not the easiest of habitat in terms of counting, where maybe a farmer would count livestock in his field quite easily. So in true terms, we don't know the actual numbers, but what we do know is the, in terms of data produced by National Parks and Wildlife Services, that would suggest that the sika deer is the most common deer, followed by fallow, and then the least common is a red deer.
But we have no natural predators for them since we got rid of the wolves. So really, are they not an untrammelled pest, eating and damaging trees and eating farmers' grass? I mean, have we long exceeded the carrying capacity for them?
Again, I suppose in terms of the carrying capacity, we don't know, because we don't know the numbers. But there is anecdotal evidence in a number of areas of the country where would suggest deer numbers are excessive. And where deer numbers are excessive, they can have a negative impact on the wider ecosystem that they exist in. But deer are very much an important part of our natural heritage. They've existed here for over 5,000 years since Neolithic times, and they're a protected species under our Wildlife Act. And I think the vast majority of people in our experience, you know, to see a deer in the wild is a memorable occasion. You know, so we don't see, there have been some unwarranted kind of negativity around deer in terms of numbers. And obviously, if you're misfortunate enough to be involved in a road traffic accident involving deer, or you're a farmer and you look onto your field and you see a herd of deer eating your grass, you mightn't have such a positive view of deer. But in general, deer are very much seen as a positive in our countryside, and they're our largest land wild mammal, so a very important part of the wider ecosystem.
I remember a few years ago there were several reports of muntjac deer in Ireland, a non-native Asian species that I know that in parts of England, for example, now has become a very common deer and indeed a pest in some areas. How are they doing in Ireland? Do we still have them?
Yeah, I think in the times that we were in with mobile phones and cameras, you know, not a lot happens in the countryside without us knowing. Somebody takes a photograph or someone sees it. But the Reeves muntjac deer is a deer that you mentioned. It originated in Asia, and originated in the UK, in the southeast of the UK, and now has spread, you know, significantly throughout the country. And you know, they're shown to cause high levels of damage in terms of browsing on ground plants and so on, which impacts on nesting birds. Here in Ireland, initially in 2011 was the first time we saw the muntjac deer in Ireland, and then the most recent reporting was 2017, when an animal was videoed in a housing estate of all places in County Donegal. And but not since then have we seen any evidence of them. It is believed, there's anecdotal evidence, that some of these animals that we've seen may have escaped from private collections, but there's no evidence to suggest that they're free roaming established species in Ireland, but something that we need to be very vigilant of in terms of if they do, because they're such a small animal, the type of habitat they live in, they're quite hard to detect. You know, some people call them the barking deer as well. They have a barking noise very similar to a fox that they make, in terms of the male deer. But really, as I said, no substantial evidence to say that they're a significant species in Ireland or have become established.
One of the problems with deer is deer poaching, and this is the illegal shooting and damaging and killing and taking of deer. I mean, if deer are to be managed in a proper way, that there are proper scientific culls carried out. So this poaching has absolutely nothing to recommend it, has it?
Absolutely, yeah. Deer poaching, or I suppose the theft or illegal killing of deer, as would be known as, is unfortunately is a very common wildlife crime in Ireland. And as you mentioned, you know, deer must be managed and managed correctly, but they must always be managed with regard for animal welfare, for safety of people in rural communities and so on. And unfortunately, this crime, deer poaching, is very much on the rise in Ireland, and there's absolutely no regard for animal welfare for rural communities. And typically it takes place at night when people are asleep in their beds, and you know, this involves discharging firearms, maybe in a reckless manner. And obviously that type of behaviour, you know, not alone puts, you know, wildlife, but also puts human life at risk as well.
While we have you there, I just was wondering, how are our native red deer doing now in Ireland? Are they numbers holding their own, or where would you find them?
Yeah, I suppose in red deer, the most well-known red deer herd is probably our herd in Killarney National Park, and has been proven. Dr. Ruth Carden undertook research in 2012 looking at the genetic makeup of the herd, and we know that the herd has continuously existed for as I mentioned earlier, since Neolithic times, over 5,000 years ago. So they're a very important herd in terms of our conservation status and so on. And in the 1980s, just to protect that conservation status, a small group was moved to the island of Inishfikelon off County Kerry as a reservoir to protect them. Because I suppose outside of County Kerry, you know, people often sort of say, can we move the red deer from County Kerry maybe to another county or to another area? And what I've been trying to explain to people is the red deer that we find in other parts of Ireland are of a different subspecies to the red deer that we find in County Kerry. So if we move deer into different areas, obviously they will interbreed in terms of with the non-native red deer. But I suppose in terms of, you know, in terms of their how they're doing in terms of the numbers have come to be quite excessive in Killarney National Park, and they have caused considerable damage. And obviously that requires ongoing management of the herd, which has been quite an emotive topic. I think the management of any wildlife species is an emotive topic. But in the absence of a natural predator, it does fall on man to manage deer. And when I look at the most recent data from National Parks and Wildlife Service for the 12-month period up to 28th of February 2019, we had over 41,000 deer declared as culled in Ireland. Obviously, those figures are unsubstantiated, but that's the data claiming in terms of the numbers. So it just shows, you know, we are, you know, there's a significant number of deer culled in Ireland in terms of, and it just shows the need in terms of having their numbers managed.
Damien, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Email mooney@rte.ie.
Is it just me, or has anybody else out there noticed just how frisky our feathered friends appear to be right at this moment?
Birds do it. Bees do it. Even educated fleas do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
Terry Flanagan has more on this story. Terry.
Yes, Derek. We've been getting a number of texts to the programme here with accounts of the exotic behaviour of pigeons in a number of different public parks. So what's going on? Any pigeon fancier worth their salt would tell you it's all about love.
When love.
But before loving comes romancing. So to find out more, I headed off to St. Catherine's Park, where I met up with local man Enda Carter.
Hey, we're up here in the park, so can we walk around here just over towards the railings?
Right.
And we'll be able to have a better look, and you'll see there's more of them, and we have a good vision point of view, and we won't disturb them.
Okay.
You can see them there now going around here in circles, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm up here now myself. I wouldn't normally look at this, you know, because I wouldn't be in the park. But I'm just recuperating after having a little bit of a heart condition.
Okay, sorry.
And I'm up here more often. And I just began to notice that strange things were happening to me because I'm no expert in things. And I realised the pigeons are at something here. And I said to myself, I'm going to have a good look at this now and see what's happening, because it's out of character for me to have an interest in something like this, but I'm fascinated by it.
But go on, tell us, what are you seeing here?
What am I seeing? I'm seeing, look, the pigeons are coming in, right? Here at the moment we have them. Look at the moment. Look there, we have the male. I think he's the bigger fella on the left, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they're walking.
He seems to be going round and round her, is he?
He's going round and round her, right? And now he's... And watch him now, look, he's going to walk, he's walking side by side.
Yeah, yeah,
hey, it's way they were courting, you know, the way holding hands like you'd see in the park or something.
And look at them now, that looks like they're kissing.
They are.
Have you seen that before?
She's kind of submissive, see the way she's kind of submissive?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And when he goes to kiss her, she drops slightly.
Yeah.
And he kisses her, you know what I mean? And then, as far as I can see, now watch.
Yeah. Okay, he's going to happen now.
Yeah, she's down and he's after mounting her, right? Now, look, he's gone.
Yeah,
it's as quick as Jiminy Cricket. It's just gone like that. And it doesn't take very long and he flies off. And this is happening every day.
You're seeing it here with lots and lots of pigeons.
Yeah, lots of different pigeons around. You'll see it again now and give it 5 or 10 minutes. Now, sometimes it might take an hour, depending on who's around. But yeah, I'm up here and I see it half a dozen times at least every morning. Yeah,
are the wild pigeons?
All wild pigeons coming in. Gicknas, as we used to call them.
Yeah,
when
we used to
kids,
call them
you
that.
Know,
yeah.
Being in the Dublin.
I think that's a real Dublin term. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The Gicknas are here, you know. In fact, that term is often related to people that were a bit stupid as well. We won't go down that road. Who walk like pigeons.
Yeah.
But anyway, no, but it's absolutely fascinating, you know. And it's, do you know what it's done for me? It's got me now that I'm trying to get to one of my mates from years ago, I was in contact, who used to keep pigeons, and I'd love to go down and have a chat with him at some stage and bring him up here, and he might know more about what I'm looking at. But I find it fantastic, you know. It's a great morning's entertainment, you know. Where else would you see it?
Gicna, there's a term I haven't heard for a long time. I
think it's a real old Dublin.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
A real old Dublin term, a gick or a gicna. I've actually never heard it outside of the city. And yes, as Enda said, it is used to describe someone who walks like a pigeon or waddles along like a pigeon.
Okay, so at this point in the report, you bring in the expert.
Indeed, and no better man than Henry Bourne. Henry is president of the Irish Homing Union Southern Region, and he told me that he keeps about 1,000 pigeons. So, if anyone can shed some light on pigeon behaviour, it's Henry.
Well, no, you know, they are very funny individuals.
They certainly are. It's very soothing in here in your loft. That sound, that cooing sound, it's really lovely.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably part of the attraction, where you can come in and you can just stand here and watch them and see what might be in form for the next race, you know?
Now, all these birds in here, these are all the males, is that right?
They're the males, yeah. They're separated from the hens for racing purposes.
Okay.
It's an incentive thing, they call it widowhood.
Right.
So you let them pair up early in the season, and then you let them sit on eggs and rear a youngster early, and then you separate them, and they stay separated until they come home from a race every week.
And then they come back to herself, is that right?
And then they come back to the missus, yeah.
Right, so it's a bit like home life, is it?
Yes, the whole idea is to try and get them back as fast as possible, and you use the incentive of the hen to make them come faster, you know?
Now, the actual courtship, it's very unusual in one sense, because we've been watching it, and we're watching the males and the females. I'm talking now particularly about the wild birds. And the way
feral pigeons, you mean? Yeah. Yeah, well, it's exactly the same for all birds. I think most birds are made the same, you know?
Yeah.
But these guys are monogamous now, they mate for life.
Right.
But that certainly doesn't stop them having a wandering eye now. You know, they will wander, but they will always go back to the same hen, even though they have wandered.
Right.
It's a peculiar, I don't know what the technical term for it would be, you know what I mean?
But even watching them in that behaviour, it's very almost loving, isn't it? The way
it is, yeah. He
seems to be mesmerised by
them. Well, they go kind of into a trance.
Yeah.
You know, and then the hen will bow down and bow down low.
Yeah, like a kind of submissive behaviour.
Yeah, and then he'll hop up. Well, you've seen it before. And then he calls what's treading the hen.
Okay.
Right. And then they do the act. And then they jump off, and then they're all full of themselves then once they perform. They run around and the cock runs around strutting himself in the hen. They might even clap off.
Yes.
Into the distance with that banging their wings as they go, saying, "Oh yeah, that's been good though, I enjoyed that, thanks
very
much."
It's like the cat who got the cream.
Let's go, exactly.
Yeah. But even watching them as he, just before he mounts her, they appear to be even kissing.
Yes, they call it billing.
Right.
It's just confirming the relationship, I think, you know.
Strengthening the bond.
Yeah, I think it's just, it may be, they may actually pass food, I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
But it's just like a kiss. Yeah.
And it cements that relationship.
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. As I say, they pair for life.
So the feral pigeons and your pigeons, they would behave very, very similarly.
Oh, they'd be first cousins. Mm. They all come from the rock dove.
But their behaviour should be similar in the mating process as well.
Exactly the same. The feral pigeons would be exactly the same, no different. 100%, yeah, because they are fourth cousins.
Mm. So I suppose we better leave them to it, huh?
Oh, leave them to it, yeah. Well, look, you know, what can we say?
Chance to be
a fine thing is right.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Now, I'm not sure this next item is for the delicate amongst you, and if you have sensitive ears, perhaps you may want to avert them right now, but it's an important story and we have to tell it despite how gruesome it is. Have a listen to this. Fresh off a plane and sleep deprived is probably not the perfect preparation to see a beach ball of plastic being cut out of the stomach of a conscious calf. But then I'm not sure what would prepare me. So writes Alex Crawford of Sky News in her account of a visit to the River Nile, which is suffering from detrimental plastic pollution. This is a clip with Alex Crawford from the Sky film Plastic Nile, which travels the rivers 6,650 kilometres from Lake Victoria to the Mediterranean.
That is the mouth of the Nile, the waterway that dumps 80,000 tonnes of plastic waste into the Mediterranean every year. And that toxic plastic in the world's oceans affects all our futures. It's an environmental catastrophe, and it begins more than 4,000 miles away at the source of the river that is the cradle of human civilization.
Well, earlier Richard Collins spoke with Alex Crawford of Sky News, and just to say again that some of you may find this interview upsetting.
Alex, your documentary The Plastic Nile is superb, but it is also very, very disturbing. Could you take us back to the incident with the calf having a large compacted ball of plastic and vegetation and muck removed from its rumen? Could you give us a visceral description of that?
Oh my goodness, it was pretty upsetting, to be honest. First of all, I didn't realise that the calf was going to be conscious and alive. I assumed we were going to post-mortem. I think a bit of a misunderstanding translation problem or something. I'd just come off the plane and landed in Ethiopia, and we were rushed off because the plane had been delayed. So we rushed off, the whole team sort of rushed off to see this vet surgery, which is in rural Gondar, right out in the open air. And there was this calf there. And it's like, oh, right. And then they said, OK, we're going to start the procedure. It's going to be local anaesthetic, won't feel a thing. And you could see that straight away it was a very young animal. It was all over in about 20 minutes to half an hour, and oh my goodness, it took all our self-control not to throw up all the international airline food as we were watching it, because it was one of the most upsetting scenes I've seen, because this animal was obviously very young. They cut into its stomach like you would. I mean, it was basically getting a sort of plastic cesarean, if you like. Cut it open. The animal was obviously not feeling anything. It was a bit disconcerted. It had very wide eyes, but it was being held and didn't wriggle or anything. And they just kept on pulling out this congealed plastic, which was actually very hard. And they kept on pulling it and pulling it. It was covered in green muck of sort of half chewed grass amongst all this mountain of plastic. And honestly, I've given birth to four babies that were smaller than the amount of plastic they pulled out of this young animal. When I was examining it afterwards, it was heavy, it was hard, and it was pretty revolting to think that this young animal had basically spent its entire first year consuming plastic. And if it hadn't had this operation, this procedure, it would have died because it was blocking its insides so that it didn't matter what it was going to eat from now on. It wasn't going to be able to survive for much longer without this muck being pulled out of it. And this is in the middle of a very rural agricultural landscape. There's so much plastic there that the animals, even the very young ones, can't really avoid eating it. It was pretty shocking.
Now, the Nile is the source of all life, really, in much of that world. And it floods the land in the rainy season and dries it out in the dry season. Now, presumably, the Nile brings in vast quantities of plastic, which it deposits on the land and then sweeps out, leaving it there. Is the Nile a problem? And then one of your protagonists says that if we don't do something about the Nile, it will die.
I mean, there were many more people that thought that. It's quite astonishing. Obviously, the Nile has given life through the centuries, particularly in Egypt, where it allowed that country to be the pioneers, if you like, all those centuries ago, because it gave fertility to the land around it. Most of the country is desert, so they're very, very dependent on the life-giving properties of the Nile. But the tributaries of the Nile that we saw, the waterways and the canals leading off it, which also have given life to, you know, countless farms and agricultural land and everything, are now so clogged, some of them you cannot even see the water. So we are talking about not a small problem. This is a massive, massive problem. And as I say, if we're so short-sighted as to see we need to deal with this problem, we really need to deal with it on an international umbrella basis, it is going to end up choking the life out of the river.
Alex, thank you very much indeed. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Not at all. It was a real pleasure talking to you all. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed to Alex Crawford and to Richard. Ain't it time for a quick text message, please?
Hi, Derek. This is from Eddie in Turles. Is it true that magpies attack other birds' nests and kill their young? I've seen a lot of magpies in my back garden. Yes, Eddie. It's true.
Yeah. Have you witnessed
it? Other things eat birds' eggs too, not just magpies.
Well, herons, I was talking about Blessington Basin earlier, and cats, of course. Cats are the biggest offender. Well, how many hundred millions of birds do they take across the world every year? Cats?
We know in the United States it's over a billion. In the UK it's about 400 million.
And grey squirrels do it as well, and herons do.
They're
it.
All at it.
It's part of the food chain.
Anyway, during the week you can email mooney@rte.ie or visit the website anytime, like rte.ie/mooney. That's pretty much all we have time for. My thanks to researcher John Riley, broadcast coordinators Jarlath Holland. On sound supervision, we had Nikki Dempsey. Thanks to Aina, to Richard, to Niall and to Terry Flanagan. We'll do it all again next week. Don't forget, second chance to hear Mooney Goes Wild documentary tomorrow right here on RTÉ Radio 1 10 p.m. Till next week, bye 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 bye.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTÉ Radio 1.